You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Welcome, I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we're headed behind the scenes of a music school auditorium. A couple dozen teenagers are practicing Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 by Bach under the command of conductor N. Luis Montez Olivar. This is a warm space with wood floors, white paneled walls, and sunlight coming from high windows above. It's quite a transformation from what was here before, says the man who helped shepherd this space into existence, Inglewood Mayor James Butts.
This building was first a Security Pacific Bank, then it was a Burger King. And so now it's transitioned on and been reborn as a cultural anchor for the city.
The 1965 bank building on South La Brea was converted by the architect Frank Geary to be the Judith and Thomas L. Beckman Yola Center. It's the first permanent space for Youth Orchestra Los Angeles, which provides intensive after-school music training for students in neighborhoods that lack arts education. Classes start next month, but this Yola Center promises to provide even more than music classes. Its creators hope it'll serve as a community anchor and play a role in diversifying classical music. Frances Anderton is a contributor to KCRW on design and architecture, and she's with us now to talk about it. Hey, Frances.
Hi, Steve.
So tell us about the Yola building in Inglewood.
Well, Steve, you're not going to find a spectacular Geary building with a whirling metal facade like the Walt Disney Concert Hall. However, you will find something very elegant with a real sense of grandeur. This is a makeover that cost a mere $14.5 million. But nonetheless, it still does have a great sense of, as I say, grandeur. And I'm sure it's going to be very inspiring to the students. And also, Steve, this is their home. Up until now, Yola's been serving their students at the sites of partner organizations. So for Mayor James Butts, this is an accomplishment for him. It's another brick in the wall of the Renaissance of the city of Inglewood, and it comes hot on the heels of the SoFi Stadium.
Over the last 11 years, we had recaptured our reputation as being a sports entertainment capital for Southern California, but we still wanted uses that added to the culture and development of children.
Now, this center, Frances, reuses an old bank building. How did Geary turn it into an auditorium for music?
Well, the main thing they had to do was turn what used to be the central banking hall into a 45-foot high performance space. That's the height they needed for good sound. And that meant making some changes. Here's the architect, Frank Geary.
We had to drop the floor and raise the ceiling, which was, it turned out, a reasonable cost to do it. And it makes all the difference.
Now, they also had to do things like strengthen the structure and put in sound protective glass to keep out the sound of airplanes, which, as you know, fly over Inglewood in and out of LAX. And Geary worked with Nagata Acoustics. That's the company that he worked with on the Disney Concert Hall. They're really the best in the world. They were testing the sound when I visited, and I'm quite sure they will tune it to perfection. The other thing about this space is they've made it feel very open. So to get into Yola itself, you wander off of the sidewalk on South La Brea through glass doors into a lobby, then through another pair of doors, and boom, you're right in the hall itself. Delaney Harris is an alumna of Yola. She herself was raised in Inglewood, and she's been watching the new space get built, and she particularly likes this feeling of openness.
The front of the building is glass so that you can kind of see inside. And so I think that that sort of opening it up visually is really cool so that it can kind of get people curious about like what's going on and like how to get, you know, involved and be a part of it.
So Delaney suggests that the Yola Center, Frances, has a place within the community of Inglewood where she grew up at large. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. Yola's going to offer these fantastic classes to around 300 students, and 160 of those students are going to be from the Inglewood Public School District. So this is definitely seen as an incentive to stay within the local school district, which helps strengthen the community. The other strategic reason is urban development. You heard Delaney mention this direct connection to the street. And this street is in downtown Inglewood, which had suffered when many sports teams exited the area. So the idea here is that Yola's going to serve as an anchor along with other investments in that area. And Gary himself has said that he designed the centre to be, in his words, a world-class instrument for the community.
You know, Francis, there's been a lot of anxiety in Inglewood about outside investment in the area. You've got the SoFi Stadium. You've got the new arena for the Clippers going in over there. And people are worried about rising property values and current residents being priced out. Gentrification. I mean, that's obviously the buzzword all across LA, right?
Absolutely, Steve. And for sure, Mayor Butts knows that change can be hard on some people living in Inglewood. He also says that that city had been very depressed up until roughly 5 or 10 years ago. It had very high unemployment and it had very low property prices. So he sees Yola as, yes, an investment from outside, but one that's very positive and will directly benefit Inglewood residents.
To say that you would forego an opportunity to bring culture, sports, and entertainment because it will make the city more desirable and increase property values is an insult to all those people that bought property and lived here for so many years. And now they have an opportunity for generational wealth to pass on to their children.
So the point that Mayor Butts is making here is home values are rising, but that's a good thing for the locals who've owned there for years. He is aware that you do have to manage the downsides, like implementing rent caps on these runaway rental costs.
Right, because not everyone owns a home. They rent and those rent prices keep going up.
Right.
You know, Francis, classical music came from Europe and it's associated with older, whiter audiences. Is Yola playing a role in changing that?
Well, certainly Yola, which is based on Venezuela's El Sistema public music program, is already bringing a far wider pool of young talent into classical music. But yes, Yola alumna Delaney Harris, I spoke with about this and she feels very strongly about it. She talked about how she wants to see classical music diversify. She herself plays the double bass. She started with the program 10 years ago when she was at a charter school in the Inglewood School District. She went on to study music. She works now for the Seattle Symphony Orchestra. She co-hosts a podcast, in fact, called Classically Black. And she is very interested in shining a light on today's young black musicians and on composers like the late Coleridge Taylor Perkinson and Florence Price, composers who blended European and African-American musical influences. She says these composers are going to be new, frankly, to most audiences.
I would say the black community in Inglewood may not have heard those pieces, but also people who consider themselves patrons of classical music, because that's not something that orchestras or classical music radio stations, etc., have been programming.
Now, she points out that changes in programming were already underway. You can see it in the calendars at the LA Phil, at the Seattle Symphony. But she does say that broadening this range has very much intensified in the last year.
So classes, as I mentioned earlier, Francis, those classes open in September. Can folks go now and check out this new building?
Well, hopefully soon. Yola had planned a public opening for the 15th, but that unfortunately has had to move due to COVID restrictions. So stay tuned for updates on that. But I do want to finish by saying that Yola is also going to make its centre available very likely to other Inglewood artists in the future. So the goal for this centre, as soon as it becomes open to all members of the public, is for it to be very much at the heart of the community.
All right, Francis Anderton, KCRW's contributor on design and architecture. Francis, as always, nice to have you on.
Lovely to talk to you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Every year, gray whales migrate between their feeding grounds and breeding grounds. They've been doing this for thousands of years, traveling thousands of miles from the Arctic to the warm waters near Baja California, where they mate. But a few years ago, these migrations went from breathtaking to alarming. Some of the whales' trips back to the Arctic were cut short as they died along the way. In 2019, a total of 214 whales washed ashore along the western coast of the United States from Mexico to Alaska. But why? Scientists, biologists, oceanographers, and others are investigating what is killing these magnificent sea giants, which is the center of a new investigation from the LA Times. Suzanne Rust is an investigative reporter and wrote a comprehensive story about it that came out just a few days ago. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
In your piece, you describe that there's a mystery behind what's killing these whales. And you said the what is anything but obvious. What do you mean by that?
So, again, as you pointed out, a lot of whales have died. I think since the end of 2018, close to 500 whales have died along the North American coastline in the western side. And that's probably just a small percentage of the whales that actually have died. Scientists suspect there are thousands more that just died out at sea and sunk to the bottom. So we'll never even see what happened to them. And the what is really unclear because, as again, you pointed out, these whales travel every year from the Bering Sea all the way down to Mexico and back. And as they do this trip, they go through every conceivable risk one could imagine off of the coast, from orcas, which are their natural predator, to cargo ships, to recreational ships, to fishing gear, to, you know, runoff, to plastic, to changing ocean conditions like lack of sea ice and, you know, warming and changes in the environment around them. So trying to determine what exactly is killing these whales is really hard. And what makes it even harder is when these whales do die and they wash up on shore, they often come up and they're decomposed. So even looking at a whale and trying to figure out what happened is hard to do.
In your reporting, Suzanne, you write about some of the whales that have been discovered alive but had deformities, or their cycles were off. They were, you know, a couple of weeks late in getting to where they normally go, things like that. Are those things any indication, do you think, or do the scientists think,
yeah,
about what's going on?
Yes, so definitely. So one of the things is the scientists, you know, get these decomposed bodies and try to figure out, is they're also looking at the behavior of whales. One of the things that's been happening over the past couple of years is gray whales generally do all of their feeding up in the Arctic, in the Northern Bering Sea and in the Chukchi. They go to the bottom and they feed off these things called amphipods, and they fill their bellies, and then they migrate south and, you know, they cavort down in the Baja Lagoons, and then they go back up. But they don't really feed when they do that. In the past couple of years, people have been seeing them feeding not just in the Arctic, but all along the coast. We saw them this past March feeding in the Baja Lagoons, and we were with people who have grown up there, who've spent their whole life watching whales. They've never seen anything like it. So that kind of information is really revealing to scientists as they try to figure out what's happening. There's something happening with these animals' food.
It's the food. You mentioned, you know, the deformities that I talked about, you know, are like the blowhole is sunken in for some reason.
Yeah, so the whales not only are acting different, they look different. The ones that are washing up on the shore, the ones that they are seeing down in Baja, sort of at large numbers like they've never seen before, are these malnutritioned whales where their blowholes, which are usually sort of plump and flat, you know, and they blow the water and the air out, they're sunken in. They look like big sort of skin-covered bowls. And then the vertebrae along their spines are poking out. I mean, they almost like, it's probably a little too much, but not that far off. They almost look like like, you know, if you've heard of the Stegosaurus dinosaur, where they have these, you know, huge things protruding from their backs. That's what the spinal column looks like on these whales. And they're, you can see the outlines of their skulls. They're really skinny, and it's frightening.
It's frightening. It seems alarming. As you said, it something's going on with their food. They're not able to get the food. This has happened before, though. Between 1999 and 2000, there was a big die-off, right, in large numbers.
Yep, there was another big die-off. And at the time, investigators, again, couldn't pinpoint the exact cause, but everybody's money was on, sort of strangely when we think about it now, the fact that there was too much Arctic sea ice. So the places where the animals fed in the summer and late summer to fall, they couldn't get to their food because there was too much Arctic ice. And so whales were malnutritioned. This time, too much Arctic sea ice is clearly not the issue. In fact, Arctic sea ice has been receding and is on the decline. And so some are speculating, well, maybe this time there's so little ice that the environment that feeds the food that they eat is no longer there, and they're just not finding the food, or that the food has changed for these whales. But something, again, where they go to feed every year has changed, and they're not getting the food that they need.
These gray whales were almost extinct, right? Not that long ago.
So the whales were hunted almost to extinction before. So that was the large killer. Human beings were the predator. And then in 1972, the Marine Mammal Protection Act came into existence, which basically, you know, stipulated you can no longer kill marine mammals, including gray whales, offshore. And you have to be very careful about making sure you're not harming them or hurting them or harassing them. And that law really sort of was a sea change for the whales, and their population has exploded since then. They went from next to nothing to, I think, a height in 2017 of about 27,000.
I mean, with all these concerns, Suzanne, what, you know, are scientists and biologists, I mean, what are they doing in an effort to stop this? Is there anything being done?
Yeah, well, right now they're just trying to figure out what is happening. Is this a result of, you know, of a changing climate, right, where they can't get the food that they need? In which case, you know, we need to talk about climate change, because it's not just these whales who are being affected. Or is it something like a disease, right? Is there a virus out there that's infecting the animals? Is it something like, you know, runoff? Is there something from the water that we're flushing into the ocean that's hurting the animals? I mean, until we know what is causing the die-off, it's really difficult to mitigate it. One thing is clear, there are things that kill whales every year, and that includes like ship strikes and fish gear entanglement. And those, like on the East Coast, for instance, where there are these whales called the North Atlantic right whale, it is clear ships are one of the major causes of mortality for those whales. And so slowing down speeds for boats, making sure that when boats are in a harbor where whales are, that they're going at such a speed that, number one, they can stop before they hit a whale, or a whale can get away. And number two, if they do accidentally hit the animal won't die. So things like slowing speeds, not leaving nets and gear out there in the ocean to entangle whales, those are things humans can do.
Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter with the LA Times. Her investigation, by the way, into these gray whales dying off is out now. Suzanne, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Moving along now with Greater LA on KCRW, and to Orange County now we go. Huntington Beach, to be specific, and a city council seat left vacant by mixed martial artist Tito Ortiz. He lasted less than a year in office. More than 100 people interviewed for his job. In the end, council members appointed Rhonda Bolton, the city's first black city councilwoman. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist at the LA Times, and he joins me now to talk about her. Hello, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So she beat out more than 100 other candidates. What made the city council go with her?
I did not read all of the applications, but obviously she has a great track record. She used to be an executive, or she used to work for Kia Motors as the diversity officer. Before that, she was in Washington, D.C. as a legislative aide, but also working for a law firm. She's not licensed to practice in California, but she is a lawyer. So, and all, on top of that, she's a mom to a junior surfer, and she's been in the city for 9 years. I think that's a pretty good candidate.
And her appointment, by the way, is pretty historic, right? I mean, Huntington Beach is, what, how much black? Like 1% black population, correct?
1.4% in a county of Orange, which is the only major metropolitan area in the United States with a black community of less than 5%. And we are stuck at 2.1%.
Not everyone, Gustavo, was happy about her appointment. I mean, gosh, you watch some of these videos. She was met with some not-so-nice words the day that she was sworn in. What happened at City Council Chambers? Can you give us sort of a blow-by-blow?
So what happened, she was appointed because, of course, Tito Ortiz had resigned because he said the job wasn't for him, whatever that means. And so, but there were supporters of the fourth-place finisher in November. So three people got elected in November. The fourth-place finisher was a woman, a Latina, by the name of Gracie Vandermark. And so her supporter said that the city council should appoint her because she was a fourth-place finisher. When it became apparent that wasn't going to happen because Gracie has this tendency to pal around with alt-right figures, and so when that wasn't going to happen, they said, well, then let's make a special election out of it. And the city council said, it's going to cost us $1 million, so we're not going to do that. So instead, we're going to do this open audition. So when Rhonda got sworn in 2 weeks ago, people booed. People also yelled out transplant. Again, Rhonda Bolton's originally from Dallas, but she has lived in Huntington Beach for 9 years. And then on top of that, when it actually came to public comment during her first council meeting, within half an hour, it was announced, hey, we're going to recall you because you are bringing a radical agenda to our children. You write articles that are anti-white, the usual Huntington Beach cheer.
Articles that are anti-white?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because Rhonda wrote an article last year on the 4th of July where she said she still has faith in this country, even though this country has exhibited racism towards her almost her entire life. And so people criticized her for writing this on the 4th of July. Never mind that she said, I love the United States. I have faith in the United States. It's becoming a better thing. But because she published it then, she's obviously anti-white.
Okay, so there's a recall. You met up with her, by the way, in typical SoCal fashion, at a juice bar the day before she took to the dais. Tell us about, you mentioned her background. She's been in Huntington Beach for 9 years now. She's a lawyer. How does she maneuver this new job, and where does she go with it? I mean, it seems like she got off to a rocky start, maybe without her own help. Where does she go from now?
She's from a career. Again, she's a diversity. She has her own now private consulting firm for diversity matters. So her job is literally to get people who do not like each other at the table to start talking. Before this, her only involvement, privately in politics, she was a member of the Huntington Beach Human Relations Task Force. So she actually moderated a series of discussions in the city after summer of 2020, where Huntington Beach made it onto the national scene for very bad reasons. Anti-mask, anti-Black Lives Matter, pro all sorts of weirdness and whatnot. So when I talked to her, I found her, she had a good laugh. She's very soft-spoken. And also, she's someone who has seen a lot of bad things in her life. And because she is a Black woman, especially being a Black woman in Huntington Beach, although she said she's never experienced racism in the city. So she's going to be as diplomatic as possible. And I actually met her in the morning of her first council meeting. I texted her afterwards and asked her, how do you feel about the recall? And she's like, look, I'm still going to do the same job I wanted to do before this, which is make sure that the city is as best as possible and, try to have the city recuperate after, 2020, where the economy really cratered because it's a city that's very dependent on tourism.
Yeah. What does she say about living in a city with so few Black people, Black residents?
She said she loves it. She tried to sell me, you know, myself, who has said many nice things, of course, about Huntington Beach over the years. That's a great place to live. I almost bought it. She said, you know, she loves raising her family there. She has two children. One of them, as I said earlier, was a junior lifeguard. She says she loves hanging out with her neighbors, and they don't always agree, but they could just sit on the lawn and just talk about things. She loves the vibrancy of the city. And she, you know, as a good politician, a good councilwoman is, she almost sold me on it. And then the city council came, and I remember that, oh yeah, this is the Huntington Beach me and OC lifer and so many of us lifers know and like to tell the rest of the world.
But now the city council, which is something that you haven't seen in a long time, Gustavo, it has a Democratic majority. Are we starting to see maybe the tides turn in a pretty conservative beach city?
As it stands, the Huntington Beach City Council has three elected Democrats, so that is a huge tide change. Rhonda was appointed, of course, so that makes it four. And that said, though, it's still Huntington Beach, so it's not just Rhonda who's being targeted for recall. Six, including her, five other of the seven council members. So six out of seven council members are being threatened with recall, all because they supported Rhonda for that. So Huntington Beach is still the two-tanned crucible of the right in Orange County. And so those folks are not going to go quietly.
All right, Gustavo, we've got to go quietly. Thanks for your time.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and attention. Have a great night.